Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Once funding decisions are finalized, applicants are notified of the status of their awards, issued program agreements, and approval letters. Then they can get started promoting their products.
Mark Slupek with the Foreign Ag Service.
Participants generally work closely with FAS in Washington and our nearly 100 overseas offices, which cover approximately 180 countries, to plan and execute their proposed activities. These market development programs are highly effective at generating an excellent return on investment and account for a high percentage of the level of U.S. agricultural exports. On average, participants contribute over $2.50 for every $1 in federal funds, showing strong industry investment. What we found over the years is that in the neighborhood of $25 for every dollar spent is accrued to the industry participating.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Yes, in these kinds of markets, when you're a margin player like we are, you get a turn or two of cattle that make a lot of money. And then, of course, you have to go replace on the same market, and all of a sudden there's not much margin left. And at some point, we know this thing will turn and go down. We just don't know when.
Buck Warbine is a cattle feeder president, National Cattlemen's Beef Association, on the current markets.
What I'm happy to see is that our market does work and it is supply and demand driven. And so now we have supply that's just enough. If we weren't making the cattle as big as we are, we wouldn't have near enough supply. And the market is reflecting that. You mentioned the packer making a lot of money a few years ago, and now we're making that. And the market will find its way, but it still works.
Talks New World Screwworm.
New World Screwworm is a nasty little insect that we eradicated when I was a boy back in the mid-60s. We know how to get rid of it, and there's a tried and true method. And so we obviously, it's been found in Chiapas and a few other states in southern Mexico coming up from Central America. And we obviously want to stop it down there and not let it get to our border. And so we're working feverishly at that. And that brings up a current issue on that. What happens is we release sterile male flies. The female breeds one time in her life. If she mates with a sterile male fly, then there's no babies, and you've stopped it right there. There's a facility in Panama that produces these sterile male flies, and they're flown up in an airplane to southern Mexico. They land, restage on different planes, and then they take them out and scatter them around and spread them where they want to. We've been recently having trouble with Mexico not allowing the planes to land, wanting some extra duties and so forth. And so we are strenuously encouraging them to let those planes land and let this process go forward, because we need to stop it right there. And we know how and we can, but they've got to do their part. And we were very grateful for Secretary Rollins when she got involved and made it strenuously so that Mexico needs to do their part in this. And so we're very grateful for her, and by extension to the president, of course.
Doing more than just talking about it, he's taking action.
Right. I was in Washington last week, and we went to the Mexican embassy, and in no uncertain and in very strenuous terms, impressed upon them the importance of them doing their part. We're all working in this together. The Panamanians are working on it. They're working on it. We're working on it. The Mexican government did a great job on the border and getting protocols in place where we could start crossing cattle again, which they're a big part of our program in the United States. And being short on cattle, we need them, actually. And so they did a really good job with that, but they need to continue that with, as I said, these planes landing and allowing that process to go. It will work, and we know what to do. They just need to let it happen.
A closed border hits producers on both sides.
Correct. The USMC agreement, the new NAFTA, is important to both of our neighbors, North and South. And we are big customers. Of course, we're big customers to everybody in the world, but we're certainly big customers to them. So you close the border down or choke it down, and you're right, that's an immediate impact. And so this New World Screwworm would cost us a lot of money if we have to deal with it like back in the 60s when you had to doctor the cattle and watch them and so forth. But it would impact their producers even more. So it behooves the Mexican government to get after this and get with the program.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
These are the biggest use categories for U.S. corn. Of course, that's the number one feed grain here in this country.
Texas A&M AgriLife Extension grain marketing economist, Dr. Mark Welch.
Number one category is feed. Number two is fuel. Down three is exports. Not exceptionally optimistic about growing feed demand in this next marketing year. We've got obviously fewer numbers of cattle on feed reported month to month. We're not seeing growth in the pork industry that we thought we were going to see as reflected in the latest hogs and pigs report. Maybe some growth in poultry. Broiler chick placements are higher compared to a year ago, compared to the five-year average. But we do know we have some constraints in the poultry industry with layers, with egg production. So it's not all, you know, rosy there either. So I'm not projecting a lot of growth in feed demand. Fuel use, gasoline demand doesn't appear to be coming back to pre-pandemic levels. And if we don't get gasoline demand back, that's going to really impede the growth of ethanol. Now, we could buy higher gasoline with a higher blending rate of ethanol. We export a good bit of ethanol. So there are some other ways to expand that category. But yet the primary driver of ethanol consumption is gasoline use. And at this point, that's not a growth industry in the U.S. So what's that leave? Tremendous amount of variability around a still a lower but a very important category of exports. And we know that with perhaps concerns and uncertainty around what that trade environment is going to look like, that category has a lot of questions around it. And this is just our trading partners for some of these major commodities and the percent of production each year that we export. So corn, for example, we export about 16% of our corn crop each year. Total use is about 16%. And I don't know if you can read those trading partners, but those that might be coming under question or subject to tariffs and trade disruptions. So the majority goes to Mexico. You know, Japan has been now considered perhaps some trade issues there. You have to circle around over here to get Europe about 5%. Soybeans, of course, China, Europe, Mexico. We're about two-thirds of soybean exports, and we export about 40% of our total use in soybeans. For wheat, about the same, about 42%, with Mexico being the number one buyer. The other major trade is going to come into question. You got to circle way back around. We're exporting about 3% to the European Union right now. So, again, some significant impacts perhaps when it comes to wheat, grain, sorghum, China, Mexico. Throw Europe in there, and you're over 90% of our sorghum exports. And then there's ethanol. You know, there's more than one way to export a bushel of corn. We export about 13% of the ethanol production in this current environment, and the biggest trading partners there being Canada, Europe, and then you can jump around over and you'll find Mexico coming here at about 4%. So there's a lot of vulnerability or a lot of exposure to reciprocal trade activity that could hit the ag sector of exports moving forward. Corn production, two things I want to draw from this slide. Those are the major producers over the last 5 years. First of all, in this current marketing year, world corn production is down. We're seeing a lower crop this year than we had the year before, particularly in the U.S., but also a smaller crop in Europe and, of course, Ukraine with all the issues that we've got going on over there. That's some interesting trends right there in China. Not only are their yields increasing, the production is increasing. If they are impacted by slower economic growth in this current environment that's evolving in 2025, that's likely to have some impact on protein consumption and feed needs in China. And if they are supplying a greater proportion of that feed domestically, they might not need the level of feed imports that they have in the last several years. So I think there's going to be some serious implications for trade in 2025, given the economic impact and the growth patterns of feed production when it comes to China.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We applaud the recent announcement that the World Bank will seek to remove prohibitions on support for nuclear energy, which could revolutionize energy supply for many emerging markets.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent at the Institute of International Finance calling out both the IMF and World Bank.
We encourage the bank to go further in giving countries access to all technologies that can provide affordable baseload generation. The World Bank must be tech neutral and prioritize affordability in energy investment. In most cases, this means investing in gas and other fossil fuel-based energy production. In other cases, this may mean investing in renewable energy coupled with systems to help manage the intermittency of wind and solar. The history of humanity teaches a simple lesson. Energy abundance sparks economic abundance. That's why the bank should encourage an all-of-the-above approach to energy development. Such an approach will make World Bank financing more effective, and it will reconnect the bank to its core mission of economic growth and poverty alleviation. In addition to increasing energy access, the World Bank can use its resources more effectively by starting to apply its graduation policy. This would allow the bank to focus on lending to poorer, less creditworthy countries. This is where World Bank support makes the biggest difference for poverty and growth. Instead, the World Bank continues to lend every year to countries that have met the criteria to graduate from World Bank borrowing. There is no justification for this continued lending. It siphons off resources from higher priorities and crowds out the development of private markets. It also disincentivizes countries' efforts to move away from dependency on the World Bank and toward job-rich, private sector-led growth. Going forward, the bank must set firm graduation timelines for countries that have long since met the graduation criteria. Treating China, the second largest country in the world, as a developing country is absurd. While it has been at the expense of many Western markets, China's rise has been rapid and impressive. If China wants to play a role in the global economy commensurate with its actual importance, then the country needs to graduate up. We welcome that. The World Bank should also implement transparent procurement policies based on best value. It must help countries move away from procurement approaches that prioritize only the lowest cost bids. Such procurement policies reward distortive and subsidized industrial policies that undermine development. They may also stifle the private sector and incentivize corruption and collusion and result in greater long-term cost. Procurement policies based on best value are better from both an efficiency and development perspective, and their robust implementation will benefit the bank and its shareholders. Related to the subject, I wish to send a strong, and I emphasize strong, message about procurement policies as regards Ukraine. No one who financed or supplied the Russian war machine will be eligible for funds earmarked for Ukraine's reconstruction. No one.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Well, I think we have to think about, over the years, the ranching industry has been really pretty fragile. And over time, there were different aspects. I think this wildlife aspect, if we let wildlife fall and cattle fall at the same time, it's critically devastating to the farming and ranching industry.
Dr. Clay Mathis is head of the livestock department at Texas A&M at a press gathering with Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins.
We're, again, so happy to be here in College Station this morning talking about one of the, honestly, the most important things and important issues in agriculture today, and that is battling the New World screw worm as it makes its way north from Latin America, meeting with the incredible producers and incredible leaders here at Texas A&M and with the Texas Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association. There's a lot of work that we have to be doing and that we've got to be on it. I mentioned a little bit earlier, I was on a call with the Secretary of Agriculture from Mexico just yesterday, and he made a commitment to us that our planes with the solution, at least the short-term solution, could begin landing today. We need 44 planes landed a week, 7 days a week, and no shenanigans from the border security on the other side of the border. So we got that commitment yesterday, and we are encouraged, as we've also been talking with them about the Mexican water issue over the last few weeks, that we are making progress. So again, what a joy to be here, but there's a lot of work to do, short-term, medium-term, and long-term, to ensure that we have a prosperous and thriving and protected cattle industry in not only the state of Texas, but across the country. And of course, as we all know, food security is national security.
and she talks about battling the New World screwworm.
There is no doubt that the potential devastating consequences of not getting this New World screwworm under control, I think, is beyond what many of us can even imagine, because it was really our grandfathers. I mean, the grandfathers of all of these cattle ranchers that are standing behind me, they are the ones that had the institutional knowledge that knew how to battle this 40, 50, 60 years ago. So we have a whole new generation now of cattle raisers and veterinarians and others that haven't really had to lean into this in our lifetime. So we've got a lot of work to do, and we've got to ensure that we're able to, you know, in this new threat that we haven't faced in decades, that we're able to protect our food supply here in America and certainly our cattle producers. When you look at when this was first faced 50, 60 years ago, we didn't have the wildlife expansion that we now do in South Texas. And to be clear, we're talking about New World screwworm as it relates to our cattle industry. But New World screwworm, it doesn't distinguish between a steer, a dog, a wild deer. It will get into everything. And so that is why this is so important, this education piece right now, but also ensuring that we're doing everything we need to do.
And a closed border means tighter supplies. Will consumers remain buyers? Arlen Suderman with StoneX.
We're still seeing good support under here. Now we need to see if the consumer will stay with us. It's been amazing how well the consumer has stayed with us to this point, especially considering how poor how low some of the consumer confidence issues have been with the tariff wars that we have going on right now. So the consumer feels pretty bad, but is still spending money for beef, and we're entering that prime barbecue season right now, and the consumer seems to still be with us.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Can we really have both massive planted acres and record yields this year?
University of Illinois ag economist Dr. Joe Jansen.
There's a common belief that when farmers plant more corn, they have to use lower quality fringe acres that drag down the national yield average. But is that actually true? Let's dive into the data and find out. So here's the situation. Corn prices have been getting a boost lately because old crop ending stocks are tightening up. But looking ahead, the USDA confirmed what everyone was thinking in March. They're expecting farmers to plant about 90 to 5.3 million acres of corn this year. And some analysts think the number could go even higher when the next report comes out in June. On top of that, USDA is predicting a national yield of 181 bushels per acre, which would be almost 2 bushels higher than last year's record. But wait, can we really have both? Does planting more acres mean using lower quality land that produces less corn? Well, let's talk about what we mean by fringe acres. When farmers plant more corn than usual, they have two options. Either switch acres from other crops like soybeans on land with the same yield potential as is typical for corn, or plant corn on land that wouldn't typically grow corn because it yields less than average. These lower yielding lands are what we call fringe or marginal acres. The conventional wisdom says more fringe acres should lead to lower national average yields. But what does the data actually show? Well, I analyzed corn acreage over the last 100 years, and it's quite a journey. Identifying fringe acres is a little bit difficult because where and what constitutes the fringe has changed over time. We actually used to plant over 100 million acres of corn in the United States before the 1930s. Acreage fell until about 1970, stabilized for a couple of decades, and then jumped sharply in 2007 when the ethanol mandate kicked in. Since 2007, we've been averaging about 91 million acres of corn in the United States, with a slight upward trend. This means this year's projected 95.3 million acres are about 3.8 million above what we'd expect from trend. That's a lot of potential fringe acres. Even in years when corn acreage was similar to what we're expecting in 2025, yields have been both above and below trend. The data doesn't support the idea that more acres automatically means lower yields. But wait, what about regional differences? Doesn't it matter where the corn is planted? Well, I looked at Great Plains states from North Dakota down to Texas, typically considered the fringe, where yields run 20 to 40 bushels per acre below the national average. Corn acreage in these states has been steadily increasing by about 400,000 acres per year since 1990. Meanwhile, traditional acres in the traditional corn belt have stayed comparatively flat. Even with this shift towards more acreage in traditionally lower yielding regions, national yields have continued their upward trend. When I specifically analyzed whether above-trend acreage in the lower Great Plains correlates with lower national yield, I again found basically no relationship. Less than 1% of the yield variation can be explained by Great Plains acreage shifts. So what's the takeaway here? Well, weather is still king when it comes to yield. Those year-to-year swings in yield have much more to do with growing season conditions than with how many acres get planted and where. That means that USDA's trendline yield estimate of 181 bushels per acre is still perfectly reasonable, even with big planted acreage. Assuming normal weather, we're likely looking at corn inventories climbing back above 2 billion bushels by the end of the 25-26 marketing year. Without a major surge in demand, which seems unlikely in the current economic environment, this level of corn availability points to prices closer to long-term averages. Current new crop futures are trading around 450 a bushel, which is actually slightly above that long-run average. So, there you have it. The data show that big acreage and big yields can absolutely go together. The conventional wisdom about fringe acres dragging down yields doesn't hold up when we look at historical evidence from national yield data.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Kind of the sine qua non for economic growth is energy abundance.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent.
We need to drive the right combination of the crawl, walk, run for these countries in charge in terms of sustainable production. But by sustainable, I mean robust and baseload, right. Not some what I would call almost a luxury belief that we have in the West. Like they are worried about pumping water. They are worried about heating their homes, running their hospitals. And we've seen that the intermittency doesn't work. Even kind of in middle developed countries, maybe like South Africa, that seems to have rolling blackouts.
Right.
So that's not a model. We want to have a model of strong baseload and then bolting on the alternative production, as opposed to beginning with alternative production and then having this latency or intermittency that makes it impossible to industrialize.
On regulation of financial services,
I think that private credit, it is the depth and breadth of our capital and credit markets that powers the U.S. economy, and it's the innovation there. I think that private credit's a very new and interesting part, but it is happening outside of the regulated ecosystem.
Right.
And I always like to say I'm not an economist, I'm an economic historian, and I think that is a distortion of the system, and it tells me that the post-2008 regulatory corset is too tight,
right,
on the regulated institutions, and we want to deregulate them or make them more able to provide the opportunity to lend to the American economy and perhaps into the international economy in a smart, safe, and sound way. As we've seen, the history of financial crises is a overreaction on one side, and I think that we had a regulatory overreaction. I convened something in the U.S. called FSOC, the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which convenes the regulators, and I think through partnership with the three U.S. banking regulators, Federal Reserve, Controller of the Currency, and the FDIC, we can come up with a system that makes the regulated financial system prosper again. And what the U.S. has that is different than most other G7 countries is just the number of financial institutions. We don't have five big banks, three big banks. And in the U.S., the community and small banks, which are provide 70% of agricultural lending,
right,
40% of small business lending, 40% of real estate lending. And in the U.S., we've had this incredible boom on Wall Street. I think Wall Street can continue doing well. But I think it's Main Street's turn to share in the prosperity. And I think it was the pullback by the small banks, the post the GFC, that's kind of created this stagnation on Main Street, and we're determined to fix that.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
USDA's upcoming agricultural trade mission in mid-May focuses on expanded export opportunities in Hong Kong and the Southeast Asian market.
In 2024, Hong Kong ranked as the 18th largest market for U.S. ag products, importing $1.4 billion in goods. As a free port and gateway to South China, Macau, and Southeast Asia, Hong Kong offers strategic access to broader markets.
Foreign Agricultural Service Acting Associate Administrator Mark Slupak says representatives from more than three dozen agribusinesses and trade organizations, as well as five state ag departments, make up the delegation for the May 12th through 16th Ag Trade Mission.
This trade mission is unique because it aligns with the USA Pavilion at the HOFEX trade show. This dual effort will enhance visibility among regional buyers and allow us to reach more potential customers than either of the events would on their own, and will feature a demonstration kitchen that will use recipes that feature U.S. ingredients during the three-day trade show.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.